discussion would be to essentially get further and hopefully to a little bit of a message in our Mechiras Chametz discussion. So as we've basically outlined so far, I'm not 1,000% sure of what we've spoken about so far. I haven't. It's okay.
Oh, I turned down.
Okay, no problem. So essentially, I think what we've basically outlined is as follows, that essentially there is a practice that we have developed to sell our chametz before Pesach with the full knowledge that this chametz will end up being reacquired after Pesach, with the knowledge that it's unlikely that the purchaser will decide to actually take the chametz any time over the course of Pesach, will visit the chametz any time over the course of Pesach. The chametz will likely, or will actually, stay in our physical residence over the course of Pesach. Many elements that don't seem to really match a genuine sale. A genuine sale when something is actually removed from your possession, never to return. A lot of the things which seem to raise a question as to how genuine this is in terms of an actual transferring of the chametz out of our possession, which seems to be what the Torah requires. By you might say, we're told we're not allowed to own chametz on Pesach. And we discussed some of the Talmudic bases for such sales, whether it's the sale of an animal that's going to have a bechor, so that we shouldn't have a kedushas bechor issue. We talked about how the Gemara does talk about selling chametz as a method of tashbisu when you really plan on getting rid of it forever. We talked about the Tosefta, which does discuss the issue of somebody who's stuck on a boat and needs to preserve his chametz while also getting rid of it for Pesach, how he can transfer it and reacquire it after Pesach. But that all falls short of what we do in terms of this mass, pre-planned, premeditated approach, and there's much discussion how appropriate is it. And we talked about some of the comparisons that could be made to the controversial sale of land in Israel for the Shemitah year. We discussed many reasons why that's considered to be much more controversial. But one reason why Mechiras Chametz is a little more controversial is because there you're dealing with a Torah prohibition of owning Chametz on Pesach, while Shemitah today, most poskim hold that Shemitah today is Drabanan. So we talked about that a little bit. We talked about whether or not there really is an Issur D'oraisa involved. We mentioned the view of the Bechor Shur, that maybe there is no biblical prohibition involved because you're also Mevatel your Chametz, you divest yourself from the Chametz. And the objection that many others raised, that it's not the same chametz. The chametz you're selling, you're not mevatel, and the chametz you're mevatel, you're not selling. So to say that we can rely on bittel to make this better, to make this only a drabanan, was a controversial point. And that's why there were those who have a practice not to rely on mechiras chametz for, let's say, actual chametz gomer, and they're only willing to rely on it for less absolute chametz constructs. And we discussed some of that back and forth a little bit along that path. I think that's most of what we've covered so far. Does that sound about right? So I'd like to mention a few more points today. One major detail that evolved a little bit historically is the role of the rabbi here. What exactly is the rabbi doing? So a model that existed in the past, but it's probably very significantly different from the model we have today for a good reason, is that the rabbi purchased the chametz from his congregants and then sold it to the non-Jewish purchaser. That is a very risky endeavor because it's highly possible that he will successfully purchase the chametz from the congregants and unsuccessfully sell them to the non-Jew. So what will happen is we're not going to accomplish anything in terms of chametz other than Pesach. The chametz is still going to be in the possession of a Jew on Pesach. All we're going to do is we're going to transfer all the Avei Rabbi Rabbi Yimotzei to the rabbi. He'll take on the sins of his whole congregation. So that's a very Christian idea. It doesn't really
sound
to, right. It doesn't really help us so much. Certainly from the rabbi's perspective, it doesn't really do so much just to saddle him with all that liability. So that's a risky endeavor. In fact, the whole point of the risk, that's why the rabbi is involved to begin with, because the transfer of property, to make sure that it's really done fully, is complicated. What exactly is the governing system of law in terms of transferring property between a Jew and a non-Jew in terms of what's recognized by Jewish law, what's recognized by secular law, is not 100% clear. It's a highly complex process, which is why we want to have professionals involved. We want to have somebody who is knowledgeable from the halachic perspective, for sure. There's also legal issues. There's also secular issues to be aware of in terms of making sure it's a valid transaction. In fact, Rabbi Willig does the Mechiras Chametz in Riverdale, which many other rabbis are involved in. So one of the reasons he is very happy with the purchaser that he has, among other factors, is that he is a real estate agent who is familiar with the laws relating to transfer of property and large-scale transfer of property and the like, so that you're dealing with somebody who fully understands and comprehends what exactly is involved in terms of sales. So it happens to be, when we do the transfer, we try to do as many different kinyanim as possible. We have many different methods of transfer that are used. I forgot what we talked about this night a little bit. We talked about that among the different transfer. So we have a contract, there's a shtar that is signed. There is a handshake. A handshake has halachic validity because it's called a situmta, whatever the minhag hamakom is, whatever the culture sees as sealing the deal, is also a type of kinyan. That's also something that automatically has halachic validity or significance in this area. So a handshake is also notable. We also have a kinyan kesef, which means that the purchaser gives over a coin as a token for the entire purchase price. It's a machlokas how a kinyan kesef works. Is a kinyan kesef a down payment, a very, very, very small down payment, even a quarter for a house, let's say, but less than a percent of a percent of a percent, but a down payment? Or is it a token? It's not really a payment at all. It's just using a coin as a symbolic type of transfer, which affects an actual transfer. That's a debate. I think we alluded to the fact that it's crucial that if you view it as a down payment, it doesn't mean that the sale is only final when the rest of the money comes in. Let's say this purchaser could be buying chametz that's worth hundreds of thousands of dollars. So he's not paying hundreds of thousands of dollars out of Pesach. He's paying a few cents. Let's say a prut or two prutos per person, per purchaser. So it'll add up to a bunch of quarters, but it's not a lot. It's not anywhere near a full percent of the purchase price, let's say. So he still owes more than 99%. So the way we understand that is that's a debt. He has to pay the extra 99%. And if after Pesach we say, okay, this debt is due a week from now, a week from now we're going to come and ask for the rest. And then if he doesn't want to pay, we'll say, listen, instead of having to pay us $100,000 for all the chametz, we'll take it back and we'll let you out. We'll release you from the debt and you'll give us back the chametz. But it's crucial to understand that this doesn't mean the sale never happened. Because if we reverse the sale, if we say it was contingent on him paying the full price, so then it becomes retroactively defined that the sale never happened and then we're in trouble. Then we might as well have never sold it in the first place. So it's crucial that that's the understanding, that it's not that the sale is reversed retroactively because he doesn't pay for it. The sale is final. When he pays his down payment of 1% of 1% of 1%, whatever it is, that is final. He owns the chametz. And after Pesach, he has a debt to pay. We'll let him out of the debt if he can't afford it by giving, or he chooses to give us back the chametz instead. We'll let him out of it, but we are not reversing the original sale. The sale was not in any way contingent on him paying the full purchase price. Otherwise, we're really in trouble. The whole thing was a waste of time.
But to make a transaction valid, we see this in other places, doesn't there have to be a general agreement as to what the value is?
So,
and I've never once seen, I mean, they ask you if you have liquor, $100, but even if you don't have liquor that's $100 a bottle, if you only have chametz that's, worth $50 total, right? 400 families times 50 is already $2,000, a lot of money.
Right.
You would think that on the star, whatever you do, you have to specifically itemize, put down the value, and then you would think that the buyer would also have to agree and say, yes, that looks like it, otherwise it's...
Yeah, so
am I missing something?
No, that's partially true. That essentially, we do try to do that. We do try to have some type of value. It's true that we don't necessarily calculate it in advance, and he's approximating. He knows that he's dealing with... Again, the Mechiras Chametz that I'm involved with, we do convey how many people we're representing. And he probably has a picture ready how much the average possession of chametz is. You're not dealing with a factory or a company, so the average family has a certain amount. So when you say you're dealing with, I represent 100 people, I represent 200 people, they have a general picture of what's going on. And the if he chooses to take the time out to read it, which he's generally not going to do, but in theory he could, that the contracts that we have, that we are asking the sellers to list an approximate value. So it's certainly not at all precise, but they have a general sense of what it is they're buying. So that they really, they could, if they choose to read it, they'll have an even more specific sense. But even without reading it, when the rabbi comes and says, as we do, you know, say, I represent 200 people who are selling the chametz, he has some sense of what that means, 200 times the average possession of chametz. Now, that's all ideal. That's what we try to do so that we want, again, the sale to be as genuine as possible, to look and feel as genuine as possible, to have as much as we can do that will make it absolute and real. However, even without that, the sale is still effective. And Rav Asher Weiss has a tshuva about that. He called this the rabbi's nightmare. And, what happens if you lose the forms? Let's say you realize, Erev Pesach, that you spent the past month having your congregants fill out these shtaros, and then you lose them. So what happens? So do you say, oh, that's it? They're stuck. They got to tell the Balabatim the bad news that all their chametz is usher, and they were also in violation of your Rabbi Matzah if they don't do something about it. So. Sorry? And the Rebbe's fire, right.
Right.
So, so this will be his last speech, Shabbos HaGadol Drasha, his goodbye speech. So, that's probably not the case. It's scary, but so Rav Asher Weiss has a tshuva where he basically establishes that as much as this is now what we're trying to do, l'chachila, ideally this is not the way we want to do it, but you can sell what we'll call door number three. You can sell a davar she'eino mesuyim if it's not defined. So even though as much as for it to be real and genuine, we want him to really have an idea of what he's buying, it's not impossible to do it a different way. It's not impossible to say, here's a grab bag, I'm not telling you what's in it, do you want to buy it? So then he chooses to buy it, that's still a valid sale. Again, ideally we're going to try to do things as specifically and as detailed as possible, but it's still possible for the rabbi to come to the purchaser and say, listen, I represent 200 people, I have their contract somewhere, I can't find them, but they are you willing to buy their joint chametz? So if he says yes and goes through the transactions, that should, in theory, certainly the Eved Shasat Chak situation, be valid. Let me address a little bit what you were asking. So essentially, because there are these complexities, that's why we want the rabbi to be involved in the first place. I think the Chassam Sofer in his drashas, and Nodi Huda talks about this, that historically, again, there's a development of how things happened. So especially coming off the Tosefta that we mentioned, it used to be Mechiras Chametz started as individuals doing it themselves. So a person would go to his non-Jewish neighbor and sell him the chametz. So the early the Shabbos HaGadol drashas that you see of the Gedolei Achronim, like the Chassam Sofer and the Nodi Yehuda. So in those days, the Shabbos HaGadol drasha was really very practical. It was about telling the details that they needed to know for the upcoming Chag. That's why they had a big drasha before Pesach and a big drasha before Yom Kippur to make these points. So many of them talk about the details of Mechiras Chametz because it was very important for the congregants to know how to do it because they were doing it, and if they made a mistake, they would be in trouble. So this was a major element of what the rabbi was teaching the congregations, how to do this properly. Hi.
Yeah. What's the necessity for there to actually be a physical contract, at least according to secular law, from that perspective, which I think is the reason for that contract?
So, well, a shtar is also a recognized halachic kinyan also.
Right.
So it's not something that just comes from the Din of the Malchusa. It's recognized by the Din of the Malchusa, but it's not generated by that. So essentially, there is some redundancy here that we're not 100% sure which kinyanim are effective under the system.
Right.
So we try to throw in as many as possible. Now, in theory, if you don't have all these, will it still be valid after the fact or even before the fact? Probably. But since there is a lot of debate about what types of kinyan work, so we basically try, we do 7 or 8 different kinyanim. We do chalipin, we have them pick up a penknife or something like that. All of that is incorporated to try to make it as 100% as possible. So since this is complicated, so preferably we'll have the rabbi do it instead of having the individuals do it themselves. But still, what does that mean? So does that mean that we sell it to the rabbi and then he sells it to the purchaser? So that's risky. Most poskim don't like that so much. Again, it's a model that has existed historically, but that's not what we see nowadays because it has its ups and downs. So what's generally done today is the rabbi is authorized with power of attorney. Some of the forms say that at the top, that essentially you are giving the authority to the rabbi to act on your behalf to sell your chametz for you. So at no point does he take personal possession of the chametz. He's acting as your representative. So what happens today when the individuals come to the rabbi and they fill out the forms, and then very often the rabbi will say, okay, could you lift up a handkerchief or something like that? So that's really not so meaningful. That's really something that we do. The Rambam talks about this, not in the context of Mechiras Chametz, but in the context of something else, that essentially you're making the rabbi your agent. So that does not really require a kinyan. But we do something that looks like a kinyan to formalize the process a little more so people will recognize that they actually are doing something substantive. So the Rambam is not talking about Mechiras Chametz. The Rambam says there are certain things like appointing a shliach, he says, which do not really require kinyanim, but we tend to have a ritual associated with it anyway. So we do that to formalize the process a little bit more, but it's not really, strictly speaking, necessary. So that comes up a lot today because technology keeps making new methods for you to communicate from long distances. So people who sign up on the internet or certainly to go back already a generation through faxes or whatever, fax in their form. So strictly speaking, again, you don't really have to be in the presence of the rabbi to authorize him to be your agent. We prefer it, but it's not, strictly speaking, necessary. So the advantages of making the rabbi your agent instead of your purchaser, so besides the fact that it's much riskier to have him, certainly for him, to have him as your purchaser, but as an agent, also it means that the question of what happens if you purchase chametz after you have the conversation with the rabbi. So I generally encourage people to come as close as possible to Pesach for a number of reasons. One reason is also because their forms will be as accurate as possible. But also because it's a question, so what happens to the chametz that you acquire after you fill out these forms? So if the rabbi is purchasing the chametz, then that's really pretty much an impossibility, or close to an impossibility, because you can't sell to the rabbi chametz that you have not yet obtained yourself. So it's very difficult to say that you are selling to the rabbi chametz that you're going to buy after you meet with him. However, if you are authorizing him to sell the chametz in your possession on Erev Pesach, so then it works a lot better. Then there is a lot more room to say that if you even acquire chametz after you fill out these forms, the forms are general and not 100% exclusive. So then if you purchase chametz afterwards, it could still be included in the...
Can I say, let's say, I'm not going to get the rabbi in time, I call up, I go, Ed, can you do me a favor, and I give you permission, can you sell my chametz?
Yeah, so in theory, you can make him a shliach of a shliach. You can say you can make him to be the agent to go to the rabbi to represent you and to bring over...
You don't need a kinyan.
Right, so again, the kinyan, that's the break the Rambam says, the kinyan is not really a crucial part of making a shliach. But you do want to make sure that you're very clear, because here selling is an absolute. You're either selling it or you're not selling it. You can't appoint two agents to sell it to two different people. So you do want to make sure you're very specific and clear. That's partially why we have the forms, which at least put something down on paper that you are appointing one person and only one person to sell your chametz.
That's widely done. And in the Kiddush Club, whenever you Orthodox Shul, the president of the Kiddush Club, takes the responsibility of selling all of the chametz of the Kiddush Club.
Right, but there, so there, well, hopefully not through the rabbi, or through the rabbi. Right, so part of it is, so then the rabbi says, okay, I want to go to the Kiddush Club, so I'll make sure all the chametz is also behana. So he won't sell that chametz. But the chametz that you're dealing with is probably not owned by any individual anyway. It's probably, so to speak, communal property.
Correct.
So there, as it is, you need to have some kind of consensus as to how we're going to get together and figure out who is the owner of this money, so to speak. All right.
So many things can go wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Why isn't there a clause that we sign when we go to the Rav that says, I understand that if the sale can't go through and informed by the Rav, that everything is going to be mavatel and I can have no hanaf from it and I will have to, dispose of it or throw it out or can't have any hana from it. You would think that that would be a standard phrase. I mean, you're listing all the possible things that could go wrong, as I see it.
Yes, I would
want that escape hatch, wouldn't you?
Well, first of all, I don't know how much of an escape hatch that is, because, first of all, how would you ever clarify that that went wrong? So you're saying that the purchaser or the seller should make the decision that if something happens, I'm not going to benefit from the chametz, but we're never going to know that that happened.
Well, the rabbi will make it, nowadays, I mean, they'll put something out on the phone, you know, thing, whatever.
Right, but it's not like there'll be an explosion. You know, it's not like something will happen that we can point to. The point is, we're talking about a subtle halachic mistake, which is not something that we'll be aware of. And also, part of what we're talking about is we're saying, because this is a machlok shoshonim and that's a machlok shoshonim, so we're trying to satisfy all the different views. It's really a klape shmaya kind of issue. It's that God knows whether it works or it didn't work. Nothing's going to happen that's going to make it clear to us that it didn't work. In some cases, something could happen. And even in those cases, I think we discussed last time that there is a view in Achronim that even then, after the fact, the chametz might still be mutter, because the act of good faith trying to sell the chametz and thinking that you sold the chametz, that may itself be an act of bittul at least. So that may at least negate your relationship to the chametz, so that after the fact it could be mutter. So I don't know if that's really, there's really much of a room for that clause. But our premise is that we don't think anything's going to go wrong. We're going to do everything in our power to cover all our bases so that nothing does go wrong. So we're not leaving ourselves an opening that something should happen. We're essentially saying we're going to try to account for all the different views and try to use all the different methods we can to make sure that it actually does happen. So one other issue that could come up, one advantage of making the rabbi.
When do you meet with this guy?
Erev Pesach, right before the time of the Isser of Chametz.
So I'm saying, if he doesn't show, I mean, again, I'm just saying, if he doesn't show up, or if you discover he's really a Russian, you also give yourself no extra time to pursue a different guy.
Correct.
You
should deal with somebody you trust. So a headline yesterday, you got a chance to read the article. It said that the IDF, the purchaser didn't show up. I don't know what they were.
A Palestinian guy that they had been using for many years,
mm-hmm.
and he just didn't show up. And the thought is that he was probably pressured to, I guess, mess with.
Wow. Well, here they have a week. I don't know what the rush was to do it yesterday. But, okay. In any event, you're right. So the days are. For the Erev Pesach, yeah, I guess so. But for the Erev Pesach sale, you should definitely deal with somebody who you trust and who.
Have a backup,
right?
What happens if this guy dies? Oh, Professor. Palestinian could literally have been killed.
Right, so that's a real issue. And it's interesting to talk about both sides of that equation. That's okay, but about both sides of that equation. So, first of all, one advantage, even though most of what we said favors the rabbi as agent rather than as purchaser, one advantage if he's the purchaser is if the seller dies. Let's say you make this arrangement a week before Pesach, and then the seller dies. So the chametz is now the property of his inheritors. So if he authorized the rabbi to sell it, that authorization is really negated now, because he can't authorize to sell somebody else's property. So the inheritors, in addition to dealing with their avelos, are going to have to now worry about reauthorizing the sale of the chametz themselves. While if they had sold it to the rabbi, so then he still is the purchaser because he bought it when the person was alive, and then he could sell it and then give it back to the inheritors afterwards. So that's one unlikely scenario where things would be a little smoother if that was what happened. But the case you're talking about is also a very practical case. So what happens if the purchaser dies over the course of Pesach? So then you have to figure out a little bit of the secular laws of inheritance. We know we do recognize the concept of inheritance for non-Jews. We have to see how the Din of Malchus also fits in. And that can be a complication if, let's say, the purchaser has Jewish relatives, which could happen. You could certainly have a situation where a secular law will understand it that Jewish inheritors have inherited. And I saw a discussion, back and forth about this question about selling to an intermarried purchaser, somebody who's married to a Jew, and there were those who were saying, well, since the halacha doesn't recognize the marriage anyway, it should be a problem. It's not so clear that it's not a problem, because if the secular law recognizes the relationship, so if you have, depending on you talking about the woman's not Jewish, the husband's Jewish, that's one issue just in terms of marital property issue. But also a concern is if the spouse dies, and then if the law sees the husband or the wife, whoever it is, as the inheritor, you're going to have a significant issue there. You could also have a significant issue because if the purchaser has no inheritors at all, then you have to figure out the chametz may have a hefker status, may be ownerless. So if you have chametz that's in your closet locked up that is ownerless, that may be you're taking possession of this hefker, chametz, and that's also problematic. So you should definitely try to be makbid not to have your purchaser die over the course of this. It opens up,
right?
Yeah, it opens
isn't
up
one guy.
It opens up a lot of
people, isn't it?
Yeah, that's what we were talking about before. So hopefully he should be well in general, but especially over the course of Pesach, he should.
Does he get any health insurance with the cigar?
Right. You think? Yeah.
They do like a physical before they start the baseball.
Sorry.
In the U.S., if there are no inheritors of property, the state inherits.
So if the state inherits, so then the state is not Jewish.
Right, but is it not, or are you considered part of the...
So but presumably that's not called Jewish ownership. This comes up a lot in Rivas issues, but it's hard to say that the state is going to be considered Jewish ownership. Even though the state is made up of Jews also, but the state is not just the aggregate of all the people in it. The state is a corporation, essentially. Now, corporations and chametz is not a pashut issue either, but in that case, I think you probably would have room to say that it's not owned by a Jew over Pesach. It's, again, a situation to do everything you can to avoid, because it wouldn't be so simple. One other issue that comes up, there's a lot of issues that come up, but we're running out of time. There's one specific point I do want to get to. One question that comes up all the time is a shiloh that every Pesach somebody has, is they find, over the course of Pesach, they open a closet and they find a bottle of liquor there that they didn't remember that they had, and they didn't know what the story was. So, I've seen Poskim say that, both orally and in writing, that, you should worry that was not part of the sale, and you should spill it out, you should get rid of it. And my inclination, I don't totally understand that, because I think it's more likely that it is sold. Because what our contracts say, they don't say that when we list where the chametz is, we say it's in the closet, in the basement, whatever it is. We're not saying we're selling you only the chametz in those locations. What the shtar says is, I sell all the chametz that I have. Now, you want to know how to access the chametz. So I'll tell you, it's mostly located in this area. Here's how you get the key. That's why I'm listing locations. I'm not listing locations to say that this is the only chametz I'm selling. I'm telling you how to access the chametz, again, in the spirit of it being a genuine sale, so I'm telling you where to find it. But not because it's limited there. So the terms of the sale are that I'm selling all the chametz in my possession. So if I should happen to come across chametz that I had somewhere else, I think that that's also, strictly speaking, included in the sale. And I think there's a real concern that you're essentially destroying property that doesn't belong to you. And the attitude that, he's probably mochel in this case, so it's safe for you to assume that you can destroy it. I'm not comfortable with that for reasons that I'll come to in a minute. So while, again, I think many postmen have taken a stance that the safer option here is to destroy this chametz, I think the safer option is to assume that it is sold. And I'll talk about that more in a minute. Another point that relates to what I'll talk about more in a minute is I also saw a question that some postmen discuss, and I think the question is better than the answer. We don't really have a great answer for this question. That in our contracts we say that we're selling all the liquors and the medicines that have chametz in them. And that's a problem in terms of Adina de Malchusa, that the law does not allow you to sell liquor without a license, and does not allow you to sell medicines if you're not a pharmacy.
Without a prescription. Generally, you have to collect tax on everything you sell.
Well, I don't know if individual sales like that have an obligation of sales tax. Now, that's something we've tried to figure out in the service in general. I'm not sure if a one-time sale does, but maybe it does. But I think the question is a powerful one. The answer is, I've seen it, not so great. That the law is not makbid because this is a religious sale and it's, they don't see it as real. I think that's the kind of answer we want to avoid in this discussion. I think the better approach is that, in terms of the liquor, it's probably true that they're not makbid on a one-time sale from friends to friends. Like if you happen to buy a bottle of liquor and you decide you don't like it and your next-door neighbor likes it and they say, give me $25, I'll give you the liquor, the government probably doesn't have a problem with that. They presumably have a problem with you opening a bar without a license. You're opening a consistent business of selling liquor. So that in that case, it's probably true, not because it's ritual, but because it's a one-time and friend-to-friend kind of thing. They probably don't have such a problem with that. But the medicines is a more complicated issue, because I think they would have a problem with anyone who's not a pharmacy with a prescription selling a medicine to any other person because of the danger involved. So there, it's harder to explain, except the stakes are a little bit less, because if that doesn't go through, so to speak, the chances that we're really obligated to sell the medicines on Pesach are slim. The chances that chametz are really, that is really an ownership issue when it comes to any of these medicines is probably more of a chumrah. So if that happens not to be a valid cause, that's a little bit less risky. But I think the question is a powerful one in general. You know, Rav Sternbach used to be the Rav in South Africa, so he had different Dina Malchus issues. He talks about when the law discriminated against who you could lease houses to, and since that's also a part of our shtar that we lease out the property, so was that a problem in terms of Dina de Malchus? We have to figure out where Dina Malchus applies when the law is discriminatory. That's itself a whole separate issue. But all of these are important topics, and it gets me to just what I want to conclude with, that in terms of the whole question we've been dealing with this entire time, how appropriate is this endeavor of Mechiras Chametz when it does seem somewhat phony? It seems like it's not a real sale. You're not going to ever see the purchaser come and take it. As much as we make it possible, we say, here's the key, here's the address, here's everything. We know, bottom line, they never end up coming to take it. And we know where it is the whole time, and we are always not surprised to see that they decide after Pesach not to pay the full purchase price and to give us back the chametz. So does that make the whole thing into kind of a joke? I think the answer is no. I think that the value of Mechiras Chametz is very significant, and it lies in the following fact, that all of this is meant to address the Isser of Bal Yirah Bal Yimatzeh. So what is that Isser about? Why is it the Torah prohibits us from owning chametz? It's an unusual type of Isser. And the Ran, in his commentary to Maseches Pesachim, in the beginning of Pesachim, the Ran says that this might be a type of siag min haTorah, that a safeguard, which we normally associate with dinim derabbanan, protective measures, but this might be one that is coming from the Torah itself, which exists, and this is an example of a few of those, that maybe the Torah really is concerned about us eating chametz on Pesach. That's really what Pesach is about. We shouldn't eat chametz. And owning is not really the issue. So why are we prohibited from owning chametz on Pesach? Because it's very likely that if you have chametz in your house and you wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning and you're half asleep, you're going to make yourself a sandwich. If you have pork in your house for whatever reason, it's not so likely you're going to make yourself a pork sandwich at 2 o'clock in the morning, because you never eat pork. So whatever reason happens to be in your house, even at 2 o'clock in the morning, you're not likely to make that mistake. But chametz, which besides the fact that it's a more severe isser, it's an isser kares, but 51 weeks a year it's permissible, so it is likely that maybe you'll wake up in the middle of the night and you'll forget for a minute what's going on, and you'll make yourself a peanut butter sandwich, if not a pork sandwich. So therefore, says the Ran, so we're told not to own the chametz so that we shouldn't come into the risk of eating the chametz on Pesach. So essentially, what are we accomplishing when we sell chametz? We're making a very strong statement. We're saying that the fact that there's an Isser Kares to eat a chametz on Pesach, that's not enough to make sure we're not going to do it. We need to physically get rid of it to keep us from stumbling in this area. But there's something else that will also keep us from stumbling. That if we know there's an Isser Gezela involved in taking this chametz, we know that somebody else owns this chametz, that also, we have enough reverence for that principle that will keep us away from the chametz. So it doesn't matter what's going to happen after Pesach. It doesn't matter what's going to happen now. It's not a question whether it's a technicality or not. The fact is, the technicality is enough to create an ister, those sigzols, enough to designate this as somebody else's property. That's going to keep us away from the chametz as well. So I think that's a very profound statement, but it's also important that we connect to that statement as much as possible. So I'm not comfortable with the attitude, well, it's probably mochel if we destroy this bottle of liquor, it's probably the law doesn't take it seriously that we're selling medicines and the like. I think anything that erodes that attitude that there's a very real low sigzol involved is probably not the direction that we want to go. We want to go in the direction that this is a serious prohibition of theft involved in taking this chametz. It also becomes complicated by the way Erev Pesach Chalios B'Shabbos, so you need to set aside some rolls for your meals. So that's supposed to be spelled out because you don't want to just assume that he's okay with it. Anytime you just assume he's okay with it, I think is further away from what the attitude we want to have. We want to really spell out any type of liberties we plan on taking, because it should all be part of the understanding that there is a real prohibition of theft here, and that's what's keeping us in line, and that's what's preventing this from being a risky situation of owning chametz on Pesach. And it's also interesting that the Smag has a famous comment. He writes, why is it that the exile has gone on as long as it has? Why is it that we've gone so long without being redeemed? He says, because we don't always deal honestly with the nations of the world. So God cannot redeem his nation as long as they don't have a perfect reputation for dealing honestly, because it's a chil Hashem. They'll say, how could God choose such a nation to be redeemed when they don't deal honestly with the other nations of the world? So perhaps we could suggest a little bit al-Pidarach HaDrosh, that on Pesach, when we talk about issues of redemption, and we look to the future redemption as well, so we go out of our way to enter into a business arrangement with a non-Jew, and we go out of our way to show how much we value the integrity of that relationship, and to not allow that to compromise anything, that we're even willing to stake our Isser Kares on our reverence for that concept. And the statement that makes should hopefully connect us to the values associated with it, so that it should merit a speedy redemption. Hashta Bagal was my card. So I will wish everyone a wonderful Chag Kosher V'Sameach. I guess the day after Pesach, I assume no one's going to be here. It's a Wednesday, Ishru Chag. It's officially designated as a travel day on the schedule. But God willing, you'll see you the week after that. Okay. Should have a wonderful Chag Kosher V'Sameach.
But that's controversy.
What was the country about what?
Somebody basically, the question was posed, how can you do contents give Hashgacha and Pesach to Luna? So the answer can make, well, that's what the people want.
But the OU does that also.
Right. Well, the OU got it. But, so I'd say, that's essentially have to serve leadership. If you know that Hashgacha is going to control the people,
right? The question is, how much do they charge for?